Welcome to Betting 360, your number one source for horse racing and sports betting insights. Coming around the bend is your host, David Duffield, with another expert interview to give you the winning edge.
Hi, this is David Duffield, and welcome to another episode of the Betting 360 podcast. I've got Vince Accardi back on the line this week, and that's because of the contribution once again of Drufus. You may have heard the questions that he had for Rick in an earlier episode. Today he wants to run through a whole heap of questions with Vince Accardi and play the devil's advocate in a way. So let's have a chat with Vince right now. G'day Vince, and welcome back to the show.
Fantastic. I'm always happy to be on the show, Dave.
Yeah, this one's a little bit different. Most of our listeners will have heard of Drufus. He was a very prolific and thorough contributor to the blog, and had a bunch of questions for Rick that we covered in an earlier episode. He's done the same for you, so if you don't mind, we're going to run through those today.
Yeah, look, happy to run through it, and let's hope that we can answer all the questions.
All right, question number one. On your website, the sample IVR report contains sectional times for the winner and leader for each race of the meeting in question.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, explicit velocities, so speeds are not listed, nor is anything I would call a rating. It is understood that velocity and rating data is probably stated elsewhere in a report. However, for the sake of clarity and completeness, could you please give the official definition of the copyright term incremental velocity rating and describe how the term refers to the data in a daily sectionals report?
Well, I think the first thing is what I believe Rufus is talking about is talking about the daily summary sheet.
Yep.
And this is what, by and large, the majority of people use, and that's the raw sectionals that are incorporated to be used in conjunction with people that are, from a serious form student point of view, like to use it in comparison with their video analysis work. And it also then extends itself to that second layer, which is that they can use that as a PAR table process, which every individual's has their own strategies in terms of how they like to collect data to create PARs, and also the last part of it is to give them a completeness in terms of what the official time was versus what the digitally internal time was, or as I stated, the IVR time.
Okay.
So that's what the daily summary is. It has nothing to do with velocity, ratings, or anything like that. It is a service that goes to the industry. People like the RVL like to use it through their stewardsmanship in terms of, as you're aware, we provide an audit service for their final times. If they're out by more than a certain point, they get adjusted. And also, it assists them in getting a gauge on various speed analysis that happens from a raw sectional point of view. And I know that many people build their own tables. That's what they do with it. Further to that, it assists them in terms of whether they're going to upgrade or downgrade tracks as well on their internal point of view on what they how they see it. Not only that, the last 600 metres that are presented in those daily summaries are also posted on all the RVL non-metropolitan tracks. So that's what that is. It has nothing to do with ratings or anything like that.
Yep. When he mentions explicit velocities, in bracket speeds, are not listed, nor is anything I would call a rating.
That's correct.
That's,
well, it's a daily summary.
Yeah, but I was going to say, so that's covered elsewhere. So the speeds are in other reports that you offer to people, and then the rating,
correct.
I suppose the closest thing that would be the benchmark, which we'll talk about a bit.
So I'll just answer specifically his question, and he was talking about the daily summary sheets, and that's what that is.
Yep. Question two was in the episode 37 with Rick. He was asked whether his ratings were convertible to relative lengths and vice versa. So the scenario was a two-horse race where he's rated one runner exactly one length stronger than the other.
Mm-hmm.
And the question was, what price would he require in 100% market to regard the weaker runner as good value, the one that's one length worse? He said yes, that they were convertible and that he'd want around $3.50 for that weaker runner. Is that question applicable to your form analysis methods? And if yes, what answers would you give?
Well, I don't think that has anything to do with sectional times.
Yep.
And it's totally irrelevant.
Okay. Question three. In one of the Champion Picks webinars, you stated that when asked to compare Frankel and Black Caviar, you found that Frankel didn't have the sectional data to match her. Is that equivalent to saying that you rate Black Caviar the superior racehorse? And if yes, consider that Timeform gave Frankel the highest rating of any horse in their history. And, oh, this is part B, but just talk about that firstly.
Well, I guess that's an interesting question. Firstly, whilst I might understand some things about how Timeform go about their assessment, I know it's not purely based on times, so I can't derive at why they may or may not have a horse superior to another. I think that's a question that needs to be asked to Timeform. From my perspective, if I was to have made that comment in terms of superior, it most likely would have been superior in a number of sections, but at what distance? If we're talking purely sprint, I'm very confident that Black Caviar would have been able to match or exceed Frankel's capability. If we're talking middle distance or longer, that's a completely different question.
And what about, I think you've already touched on this, but it says, given that both Timeform and Daily Sectionals obviously do time-based analysis, what explains the discrepancy between the two opinions? And you've mentioned that although they're called Timeform, that they're probably not as focused on that as you are.
That's correct. They only use partial times. They use official times in many times, as we know, through the history of the last 50 years. And it doesn't matter what country it is. Times are very inaccurate. And I've got lots of proof from lots of places around the world that that is the case. So I guess there's always a little bit of a question about the accuracy where they put their time incorporation. But I, from what I understand, they use a lot of other methodologies in terms of their standings in winnings of races, whether they be group class races or certain handicapping scales that help create a final figure. So it is not a product that's purely based on time. And perhaps the word time form may not be a true reflection of what they are.
Yeah, it's somewhat of a misnomer.
Correct. Something that used to be in the 20s.
Yeah, the fourth question, and this is a lengthy one, so bear with me. Referring to a research paper entitled Speed, Pacing Strategy and Aerodynamic Drafting in Thoroughbred Horse Racing, it shows the average divergence in speed of runners finishing first through 15th. The chart indicates that the speed of all runners is declining in the final sectionals, including that of the winner. And the paper says the divergence of competitor speed at the end of a race emphasises the head-to-head rather than the time trial nature of horse racing, as in the horse that slows down the least wins. In an attempt to keep abreast of faster competitors, less capable individuals reach a point of extreme fatigue before the end of a race and show a dramatic fall off in speed. Do you agree with this conclusion? And the phrase, the horse that slows down the least wins, is hinted at in your sample IVR summary. The last 100 times and more than 50% of the last 200 times in each case, and presumably last 50 times would be more than 50% of last 100 times?
That's a very complex question that probably I don't believe there's any simple answers. First of all, I haven't done any studies about the aerodynamics in terms of understanding the efficiency of various things in terms of their shape. What I do know is race speed, acceleration is all based on race pace. I have seen horses that can be known as hurdlers, that can go very slow early and have booming finishes late, and then we can have situations where horses go very fast early and are de-accelerating late. In many cases, it all comes down to the energy exertion through the race from start to end determines the outcome of the speed late. There is no set answer to this, and I wouldn't be one that would sit down and do a study to understand how many races are accelerating. I believe everything's a very unique race. Each race has their own characteristics, and whilst it may form some sort of a pattern to the past, subject to the track layout, wind conditions, blade of the grass in terms of its high density, low density, many, many things that play a role in the outcome of the fatigue of speed, and there is no one simple answer.
Okay. Do you know, in percentage terms, say if you're talking about the last 200 of a race versus, I don't know, maybe not the first 200 because it's a standing start, but you know, another 200-metre section of the race, how that compares to the last 200, is he right in saying that that is the slowest part of the race when the fatigue sets
in? Generally speaking, that's what happens. But it depends on at what point. If it's a 400, like if we talk about a barrier trial, in many cases the last 200 metres is their most explosive part.
Yep.
I've seen it many times. I'll give you a prime example of horses like Piero, for instance. He would just sort of jog along in his barrier trials and give you no indication of how well he's travelling until he hits the last 200 metres. And then all of a sudden, he'll go from running 11.5 seconds as an example to 10.4. That would be a very sharp increase in acceleration and obviously not fatiguing out. So I guess that question needs to be thought out a bit more.
All right, this is a follow-up to that, and it says, in contrast to sectional data, there is instantaneous speed data, like the data produced by a speed camera. Subtracting each runner's finish line speed from their 400-metre point speed would give a fatigue figure. For example, a runner going at 17 metres per second at the 400, declining to 14 metres per second at the finish, has a fatigue figure of -3 metres per second. How useful would you suppose data like that would be for form analysis?
Well, I can't see how that would help in the sense that it's all determined by the race shape and the, and the track nuances and the collection of data for that track, because every track has its own set of characteristics. And if we were just talking about a straight line and every race was always run in that same track and under the same circumstance, like if it was undercover and we had a straight line and they were all running on, we'll make an artificial turf that can never waver, can never be affected by wind, rain or any other, or weight, then there would be a relevance. But one has to be very careful when you study that. It is unfortunate that you can't just use that as a point that would assist, because it's very scientific to what's going there. And unfortunately, racing is a very inexact science, because we're an outdoor sport which revolves around many, many factors other than any one single factor.
Definitely. And there's some talk of weather conditions later on, so we'll leave that one for the moment. Question six is, it's another long one. Human sports like athletics and swimming focus heavily on sectional data, or more specifically on split times data. A split time is the time it takes an athlete or race leader to cover a meaningful fraction of a race, and the halfway split is commonly used because it indicates how evenly the athlete consumed energy over each half of the race distance. Racing nirvana, for me, would include 3/100th of a second accurate times for each runner in the race, covering reaction time, the time it takes a runner to cross the starting line after the race clock commences, split time, the elapsed time for each runner at the halfway mark, and the final time being the race time for each runner. Obviously, we're a long way from this. However, suppose we did live in this nirvana, how does sectional data improve on my definition of racing nirvana and breaking races down into smaller sectionals than the first and second halves? Is that overkill, or at least would result in diminishing returns? What am I missing?
It's an interesting question. It's one that I've done a lot of study over the last 25, 30 years of human movement and athletics in particular, study of training. A lot of points can be sort of reanalyzed into thoroughbred racing to give you insight and views on performances of racehorses. But in terms of the actual times, lap times, split times, that is very, very difficult to be able to transfer that in terms of an advantage for horse racing. With the humans, when you talk about distance racing, if we're talking 5,000-metre race times, or we're talking 10,000-metre race times, or are we talking marathons, or are we talking 400 metres or 200-metre sprints? Or are we talking 100-metre sprints? So I feel that what Rufus needs to think about here is we really need to get down specifically when we talk about that contrast of comparisons. What distance are we talking about? Because there are so many variables. And once you start moving into middle distance athletics of running, that's a completely different scenario in terms of tacticals, manoeuvres that happen versus the sprints. The sprints, it's all about explosion, getting that perfect reaction time and getting out of those gates very, very fast or out of the blocks. So a perfect example would have been, let's say on the weekend, people that would have watched Lancome Rupee, one of the great assets that happened for Lancome Rupee on the weekend from that inside barrier was the fact that it just jumped so impressively out of the gates. It actually had a length lead start sooner they jumped. So in athletic terms, for a sprinting point of view, that's a tremendous advantage. Then when we talk about 400-metre racing and we're trying to get some comparison on times, everybody have got their lanes. And it's very interesting. Some individual handle certain acuity of bends better than others in terms of their efficiency, their body structure. So that also has complications. So I'm not sure how the times would be of relevance in the way Rufus has presented it to be of assistance in horse racing.
You just mentioned the handling of a bend. Have you looked closely at, I suppose, the exertion point and just how horses respond to whether they're, you know, cuddled around a bend versus, you know, really being asked for an effort?
Yeah, horses have a lot of challenges for bends. Some handle it better than others. Again, it comes down to the circuit that they race on. And we are in a situation where, I'm not sure exactly, but I do feel we have, was it over 400 tracks in Australia? I think at one stage we could have had more than 500 tracks in Australia. There's a lot of racetracks. We typically run on more than 44 tracks a week. So it comes back down to some horses will handle some better bends better than others, depending on the acuity of the turns and how sharp the angle of move it is, if there's a hill rise in it or not.
Okay, and question number seven is, it's a short one. What does the study of sectional time data indicate about horses that either love or loathe wet tracks?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and a very wide one, because what we have to sort of understand here is, when we talk about wet tracks, what type of wet track are we talking about? Are we talking about a track that's just got marginal give in, or are we talking about one that's very, very heavy in its ground? So we really need a very specific question for that to get absolute clarity, because there's a wide variance in terms of horses' capabilities in handling the ground. Mainly it comes down to the stretch and the stride. One horse that we could, again, use as a perfect example if we want to look at what took place at Randwick on Saturday. Messina, I only just studied the figures of Messina yesterday in a lot of detail, and what I noticed is that its sectional splits against the benchmark in four sections of the race, three of the four sections were very, very, very even in terms of its speed. And what that showed me was the horse was not extending to its full acceleration when compared to other performance that this particular horse has, and then comparing it relative to that race and on that day. There was a lot of horses which were either de-accelerating enormously or accelerating with improvement, but this particular horse maintained the same speed all the way through, which gave me insight that this horse was not stretching out. So that's, I guess, one way of looking and getting assessment through sectional times. You do get a level of insight on a horse's ability or inability to handle the ground.
Okay, and you mentioned the state of the track and you know, whether you're talking about a...
Well, this is a big question here. This is what I mean by about the wet tracks. The perfect example, like Randwick, around the back of the circuit to right up until we approached the 800 metres, that was a genuine heavy nine. From the situation, there was a point there between the 6 and the 400, we had a dead track. So that's one instance about the variance in the ground. It's not even. It's not the same all the way around the circumference. So what we have happened in these situations is we have faster and slower parts of the track. Now, if it's very, very heavy early, it's going to have a lot more fatigue potentially on a horse late if they're working in terms of, like, if they go a lot quicker than what they would normally go in a high-pressure competitive race. There's a little bit of misjudgment about that ground. They will sort of internally start to shorten their stride a lot quicker because of the work they've had to do through the first half. Or if that part of the ground's quicker and then it becomes slower, that also has a massive impact. So racing has a lot of dynamic challenges, and just because they put up a track dead four or slow seven or heavy eight does not mean that that's how it is around the entire circumference that the horse is running at.
Yeah, I think up until not so long ago, people would just assume that if it's a you know, heavy eight, that it's like that throughout. But you've clearly shown that that's not the case. I just had a question about, I suppose, energy exertion. So if there's a track that has parts of it that are, you know, dead, slow, and heavy, you're not so much on the form side. You're producing the data that the form analysts use. But how do you handle a horse? How should people handle a horse where, say, they've been really asked for an effort in the heavy part of a track, whereas, you know, say the winner of the race made up a lot of ground in the dead part?
Yeah, well, this is a big advantage. If one studies this close enough and has the relevant data to look into this area, one can get enormous benefit in terms of this understanding. I look at a lot of horses, and when they exert themselves in the quicker part of the ground, they can have massive advantages. A perfect example would be Lucia Valentina at its last start victory. There was a section of the track which was probably about four lengths quicker than most of the other course, and it was just so ironic in that particular race. I don't know whether it was Hugh Bowman's ability to just have that feel or not. But he was going very, very gentle speed through the worst part of the ground. In other words, getting maximum conserving of energy. And right at that point, whether we call this luck or that sense of knowing that he could feel the difference in the ground, Mathieu Valentin actually accelerated in the best part of the ground and made tremendous ground up in a section of the course where it was actually superior in terms of ground conditions. This gave this runner an enormous advantage. Now, other horses in that race, they worked a lot harder through the heavier part and were disadvantaged. So if you had that insight, that would be tremendous knowledge in terms of taking that form into future races. And particularly, we've seen a lot of racing in Sydney in recent times where Randwick in particular, they have fast lanes and slow lanes. And knowing if you can watch a horse very carefully and time their runs or have the data that clearly demonstrates that they have taken a particular lane where it could have a 3, 4, 5 lengths advantage. Again, that will all come back down to what sort of exertion they've used earlier. That's a big insight and a massive advantage to the form students that look into this. This would give them a major, major advantage.
Rick's all over it. Don't worry about that.
I have no doubt. And that's one of the things about Rick Williams. Well, I recall Rick when I first spoke to him. He has absolutely immersed himself in understanding all facets of the game, not just handicapping and rating. He has taken a very serious interest in understanding sectional times and the types of information that can be derived from it to give, I guess, himself and all the subscribers of Champion Picks an advantage.
Yeah, very true. Question number 8 is, when using the term benchmark standard, you're referring to average sectional times for a given track and distance on good or dead going. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct. Everybody has their own philosophy about what a benchmark standard is. The typical benchmark standard that I believe is used, and I will not say that everybody uses this because everybody has their own philosophy, I guess, but in the main, people will use a benchmark standard based on the final time at the 600-metre point, and that 600-metre point would also create an early time and a late time. And then they would base it, if it's on a good track, they would start to build a benchmark for average times. And then you run either below or above that to give you the insight on the horse's performance. And that is subject to whether you're aware if that time is accurate or not. In the main, I would say there's a small number of people that would have accurate figures, and the majority of people wouldn't. So one has to be very careful when there's the discussion of benchmark time. So no, I don't use that philosophy in terms of benchmarking. I use that
just
only from a ground point of view. I'll take a lead time through each section so I can get clarity around how good the condition of the ground is at various points, because I typically take the time from the 1,200 metre home in 200 or 400 metre increments, and that gives me insight off the lead speed on what the assessment of the ground is. And from that point of view, I would have a lead speed, which is purely based on good tracks, to give me insight about what the ground condition is. As for benchmarking for individual runners and getting their assessment on class and their performance, I use a completely different method.
Do you want to talk about that, the first four across the line?
That's correct. So basically what I work on is I work on the philosophy of the first four runners across the line to give a bit more balance and structure in terms of having a more robust figure. And in the beginning, a horse may win by 6 lengths, and then the second or third horse, there could be another 3 or 4 lengths apart. So that's a pretty big gap. But generally speaking, the margins are reasonably tight. So by putting the first four horses across the line, what it does is it gives me assessment of what the philosophy is of horses that are in the money. Because our betting and process of when we like to punt, it's all based on typically the first four horses across the line, because the fourth horse plays a role as well for people who are playing exotics and various other forms of betting. Just like the third position is just as important as the first position in terms of whether they could be playing trifectas or standout type betting. So I felt that for me to have a robust process moving forward and get a better equilibrium on the class of a runner, because that's what we're trying to identify, I learned very early in the game that if I was to work on the first four horses across the line, I would have a much more robust process moving forward. And that's been the case. I, on very few occasions, I would say that I've been left hanging in the wrong description of what I felt the horse's ability was.
Part B of the benchmark question was a couple of recent New South Wales stewards inquiries into the performance of jockeys have not only drawn on your expertise and data, but have adopted your terminology and definitions in assessing the case against rides.
Yes.
Where runners had early sectionals way above, much faster than, the average for that track and distance on tracks rated 3 through 5. Please comment on the suggestion that Racing New South Wales stewards' adoption of the term benchmark standard is likely to be confused with benchmark handicapping, and that when charging a jockey with excessive pace in the early sections of a race, the definition of excessive should be based on data that more closely matches the official benchmark of the race, track condition and time of the race.
Well, not that I want to be answering this question for the stewards, but I do have some insight for Racing New South Wales. They have their own benchmarking that they have been doing for well over 20 years. And yes, because Daily Sessional does provide to the ATC race clubs data which can be available on their website, they obviously have the insight, and there has been situations from time to time where they would ask for specific information to assist them in having more clarity, and perhaps they might have overstated a situation or understated a situation, so they use that, as I guess, as a separate reference to it. But they do have their own standards, and I have no doubt that they would use it relative to the conditions that apply to that track on the day. I'm pretty certain that's what they would do, and really the times they've used the information and the various reports that I may have provided them is to give them further clarity, or I guess conclude what they may have already thought.
Drufus asked about benchmark standard as a term versus benchmark handicapping, but that's more of an issue for New South Wales rather than yourself.
Correct.
Okay, Vince, well, we're basically halfway through the questions that Drufus had sent through, so we'll leave it there for this week and we'll pick up from where we left off next week.
Thanks for tuning in to Betting 360. Get more in-depth analysis, tips, and that betting edge by heading over to championpicks.com.au, where you'll find a full transcript of this episode. If you like the show, share us with a fellow punter or drop by iTunes to leave us your thoughts. Betting 360, punting from all angles.